I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Back in the 1970s, when I was in elementary school, I was fairly ridden with anxiety whenever the school grown-ups would corral us for what they called an aptitude test. The achievement tests, those didn't scare me quite so much. But these aptitude tests, they were rituals that just seemed defining in my young mind. The idea was that somebody could give me a piece of paper with bubbles on it. I would fill those bubbles in with a number two pencil, and the results of the test would tell me, or at least the adults would tell them, what I was likely cut out to do with my life. Did I have an aptitude for science or language or one of the helping professions, maybe mechanical work? Was I likely to become a teacher, a politician, a builder of bridges, a lawyer, a doctor, a tax auditor, what have you? Aptitude is a very curious notion in some ways, I think. But I suppose there are genuine aptitudes for various skills. And people do gravitate sometimes naturally towards certain functions. Some of us are forced into functions that just seem awkward for us. We're going to be talking about a certain kind of extremely valuable aptitude that may be pronounced in a subset of the human population. I'm talking about people whom we describe as being on the autistic spectrum or the autism spectrum. What if some of the most insightful and inventive observations about our world have come more easily, more naturally to this unique population than to other people? To explain what I'm talking about, we have with us now Simon Baron Cohen. He is a clinical psychologist and a professor of psychology and psychiatry at the University of Cambridge and a fellow at Trinity College. And he's director of the Autism Research Center in Cambridge and author of a book titled The Pattern Seekers: How Autism Drives Human Invention. Simon Baron Cohen, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you very much, Marcus. Thank you for inviting me onto the show.
Is there really going to be in our conversation some discussion of a unique, and I don't even know if aptitude is an archaic term. Do people still talk about aptitude for this, that, or the other thing?
I think so. I think your listeners know that word, and you know, we none of us are good at everything. We have aptitudes in certain directions, and we need to know what our strengths are, and you know, follow our strengths.
So I presume that as we're talking about autism, you will be talking about a strength that has been overlooked in this population, probably routinely.
That's absolutely right. So, you know, autism is a disability. We've known about it since the 1940s, but most of the research has focused on the disability, on the aspects of the mind that autistic people struggle with, which is social relationships, social understanding, and communication. And what's been overlooked is many of their strengths, and one of them is what I call pattern recognition or systemizing. Being able to see patterns as systems, whether we're looking at a mechanical system, you know, like how a car engine works or a bicycle works, or whether we're looking at an abstract system like mathematics, or a musical system, you know, a system of notes, or a natural system like the weather. You know, these all follow patterns. And autistic people, you said they're only like 1 or 2% of the population, but they seem to be strongly drawn to these sorts of patterns and have an aptitude in understanding them.
When you say strongly drawn to them, what do you really mean by that? Is this where on a daily basis, as a person has various stimuli of all kinds, visual and aural and what have you, coming in, that a person is has an appetite for establishing
exactly.
Some order?
Yeah. Yeah, I like your word appetite. You know, we started with the word aptitude, and now we've moved to appetite.
Yeah.
but basically, you know, it's what does the person do when they're not being told what to do? What's their natural interest? You know, like if you just watch a young child, some kids will play with dolls, other kids will play with Lego, some kids will want to take things apart and see how they work. Other kids will go straight to a musical instrument. You know, it's just kind of, you know, we're all different and we have different sorts of drives or appetites to go towards different things in the world. And autistic people, it seems, have a strong drive to go towards anything that is systematic.
So is this more about the drive or about the capacity?
It's very difficult to tease those two things apart, you know, because if you're interested in something, then you're going to spend more time doing that, and you're likely to get better and better at it. So, you know, the more opportunity, the more practice, the better you get. But, you know, what we're looking at is, you know, what do kids do? And indeed, what do we do as adults? Not when we're being told what to do, but when we have choice about what we want to do. And, you know, when you watch a kid and they're surrounded by all kinds of toys or things in the house, you know, they choose one thing rather than another. And to me, this is suggesting that we're not all the same. Some kids are more drawn to, for example, objects. Other kids are more drawn to people. And maybe we'll come back to that distinction.
Yeah, I do want to do that. Absolutely. I want to jump right now, though, to the subtitle, How Autism Drives Human Invention. That's the subtitle. And when I think of that word invention, I immediately think about the great inventors through history. And that's a bold claim to say that it drives human invention. Are we talking about some of the great minds of the past, perhaps?
Yeah. So in my book, The Pattern Seekers, it opens with like a story about somebody, a child, who's really fascinated with how things work, wants to read everything they can on physics, on chemistry, on biology, just kind of trying to understand the world. And that turns out to be Thomas Edison. You know, right from his young childhood, he was fascinated to understand things. And he went on to be a great inventor. We know him most famously for having invented the first electric light bulb, but actually he invented hundreds of things with lots of patents. But interestingly, if you look at his biography, a lot of his behavior might today have been described as having a lot of autistic traits. But that's just a kind of anecdote, if you like. What we really need is research or science behind it. And we did a big online study of 600,000 people where they took a questionnaire, all about what I call systemizing. How interested are you in systems? We talked a little bit about different kinds of systems. And what we found was that that people who score high on systemizing, people who are strongly interested in systems of one kind or another, if you look at their DNA, many of the genes that are associated with being a systemizer are also genes that are associated with autism. So that gave us one clue that, you know, the capacity for invention is linked to autism, even in our DNA.
So would I be wrong, having listened to everything you've said so far, would I be so wrong in saying that we are really talking about what are routinely referred to as high-functioning autistic individuals?
So people who are inventing, if we're talking about people who can, for example, commercialize their invention, then clearly they have to have at least average intelligence, if not above. But I think when we look across the whole spectrum of autistic people, even those with learning difficulties or, you know, below average IQ, you still see this fascination with systems. But it may be in one autistic person that they love to watch an electric fan going round and round, or they love to watch the washing machine going round and round, because it's a system. There's a pattern to it. And so even in those with additional learning difficulties, you can still see this signature, if you like, of a fascination with systems.
When I think of that word fascination, I have often wondered if there is some comfort for the individual derived in this by watching, say, you mentioned a ceiling fan and a repeated pattern. Do we know anything about that?
Yeah, so the very comforting thing about systems is that they repeat, you know, that they are lawful. They follow laws or regularities. So just like the bicycle wheel, watching that going round and round, you'll see the same pattern over and over again. or if you switch on a light in the house by pushing the switch from off to on, you get the same result every time. Or if you do mathematics and you cube the number 3, you'll always get 27. So, you know, these are patterns in the world, and autistic people probably do get some comfort out of the pattern because, you know, they are predictable. And maybe what causes them stress is the social world, which is very unpredictable. You know, other human beings don't always say or do the same thing over and over again.
So the aspect of surprise is potentially stressful.
I think that's right, that it's fine to have surprise, you know, when you're trying to figure out how your computer works, because you can go back, you can retrace your steps, see if you get the same result each time, or if you maybe push a different key or perform a different action. You can systemize the machine. You can figure out how it works. In the world of people, of communication, of relationships, you know, it's much more difficult to go back and do these systematic tests. And that is probably very stressful if what you crave is predictability.
I do want to talk about that in just a moment a little bit more. There's something that you refer to as the empathy circuit, and I think that does get into these social concerns. We're visiting with Simon Baron-Cohen. He's a British clinical psychologist and a director of the Autism Research Center in Cambridge. He's author of The Pattern Seekers: How Autism Drives Human Invention. Back in just a moment. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. It's a great pleasure to have with us Simon Baron-Cohen. He is author of The Pattern Seekers: How Autism Drives Human Invention. He's a professor of psychology and psychiatry at Cambridge. Simon Baron-Cohen, I just briefly mentioned a moment ago the empathy circuit. I like to talk about empathy. I like human beings. I like social situations. I thrive on relationships with people. And empathy has been just such a big concept in my life. And I have met people who are challenged with this aptitude for empathy. The ones that I have met in the past, for me, it doesn't have so much to do with, well, yes, I've met autistic people who I think, well, they can't relate in the same way. I know that narcissism, for example, and empathy gets talked about a lot there. What is the empathy circuit?
So the empathy circuit is, as it sounds, a circuit in the human brain that allows us to do two things. One is to imagine what someone is thinking and feeling. But the other is to respond with an appropriate emotion to what someone else is thinking or feeling. So there's kind of two different aspects to empathy. Autistic people tend to struggle with the first of those, being able to imagine, you know, being in somebody else's shoes and taking another person's perspective and sort of, you know, without being told, imagine what they might be thinking. They don't seem to struggle with the second aspect of empathy, having an emotional response once they know what someone is thinking or feeling. So they're not uncaring individuals. You mentioned narcissists. You know, autistic people are not like that, nor are they like psychopaths who, you know, who also are associated with empathy difficulties. In fact, I think they're probably the opposite of psychopaths, because psychopaths can, you know, they're very good at the first part of empathy. They can read other people. They can imagine what somebody else might think or feel so that they can manipulate and deceive them and even hurt them. But they don't seem to have the affective part, the emotional response to someone else's thoughts and feelings, which is why they can be quite cruel.
Do I dare bring up the word ethical response, you know, in all of this? The idea that somebody would behave ethically seems to tie into that second aspect of the empathy circuit you're talking about, the caring part, the affective part.
I think that's right. That's a really interesting connection to make. You know, and autistic people, the ones I've met, are very ethical. They're very moral. They want to do the right thing. So they do care about other people, but they may just have difficulties reading other people.
So back to Thomas Edison, you said that anecdotally that perhaps he was on the autism spectrum. And there might be evidence, you say, in some of the documents of the time or stories told about him that he couldn't tap into what other people were thinking unless he was invited to do so.
Edison was very interesting as a person. You know, he was obsessive, and that could be one trait of an autistic mind, if you like, that once he latched onto a problem that he wanted to answer or solve, he wouldn't let it go, even if it meant working right through the night. And in fact, he moved his mattress into his workshop, or his wife did, because he was, you know, spending day and night in the workshop. He was fascinated by other kinds of patterns, like Morse code, and even named his children after different symbols in Morse code. So, you know, he was definitely different, but we shouldn't really speculate about historical characters. You know, what's much stronger as evidence is to look at living people. You know, I told you we did that big online study where we were able to look at people who work in STEM, science, technology, engineering, or mathematics, and people who don't work in STEM. And we found that those who work in STEM score higher in terms of autistic traits. And that was 500,000 people. So it's probably a solid result. But again, showing a link between people who have an aptitude, to use your earlier word, an aptitude for invention or for understanding systems, and a higher number of autistic traits.
There is, it seems, from what you've written, some correlation to across the generations, that you can look at parents or grandparents and see a tendency.
Yeah. And again, we wanted to test this. You know, I'm a researcher, a scientist. That's my day job. And we wanted to test it. So we wanted to look in Silicon Valley, where people who have an aptitude at understanding systems, they might be living there, raising families, and we could see whether they were more likely to have an autistic child, if it was the case that the genes for invention, the genes for systemizing, are linked with the genes for autism. So we did our study actually not in California, but in a Silicon Valley closer to where I live in Europe. It's the city of Eindhoven in the Netherlands, because Eindhoven has had the Philips factory there for over three generations. It's also, and so attracting people who have an aptitude at engineering to move there and start families. It also has an Institute of Technology, a bit like MIT. So for many reasons, Eindhoven was a really interesting city to look at. And we looked at the autism rates there in comparison to two other Dutch cities, Utrecht and Haarlem, matched for size and for other demographics. And sure enough, we found that the autism rates were twice as high in Eindhoven compared to the other two Dutch cities.
So we are almost certainly talking about a genetic inheritance thing going on here.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've known for, you know, maybe 20 years now that autism is strongly genetic. It's not 100% genetic, but genes have been found in association with autism, and autism runs in families. But what this new work is telling us is that the genes that contribute to autism don't just contribute to disability, they also contribute to aptitudes or strengths in understanding patterns or systems. When you look back in the earlier generations where there's a child with autism, you don't necessarily see autism in the parents or the grandparents, but you do see this aptitude in systems.
Now, I want you to tell us about something really quite fascinating, if you can. The Israeli army has a special unit that involves pattern seekers.
That's right. So it's just one example that I discuss in my book, The Pattern Seekers, of how, you know, employers could be hiring people, autistic people, because of their skills. So in this case, we're talking about the Israeli army, and they have a unit just for autistic people to look at aerial photographs of the ground to see if anything is unusual in the patterns. You can imagine thousands of photographs of what's going on in different, taken from way up high. But autistic people could look at those photographs and they're much quicker at spotting if something has changed, if there's something unusual. And of course, from the army's perspective, that could be a sign of terrorism. And the earlier that they can detect it, the more warning they have. But it's just one example of how autistic people can be making a contribution in the workplace.
Well, what you're saying seems to indicate that we could rethink our education systems, our workplaces, our professional spaces, if we were to better appreciate this aptitude of pattern seeking among the autistic population.
Absolutely. I mean, maybe we should go back one step, because your listeners may not appreciate that the majority of autistic adults are unemployed. So although we're talking about them having a strength, which should make them very employable, for some reason, most of them are not getting a job. And it's probably because there are all kinds of barriers, you know, that when we hire people, we expect them to sit through an interview, and we judge people based on their social skills, on their communication skills, which, if you think about it, is almost a form of discrimination if your disability involves social and communication skills. You know, really what we should be doing is, you know, encouraging autistic people to apply for jobs, but instead of asking them to sit through an interview, maybe give them a task to do that's relevant to the work and see how well they can do that task. You know, give them a chance to help them into work. And the same is true in education settings. You know, we can make all kinds of changes to make it easier for autistic people to stay in education, because many autistic kids drop out of school simply because at the moment, you know, schools, colleges are designed for the majority, not the minority, and that may not suit their learning style.
So are you suggesting this elsewhere than in this book? I mean, are you having conversations on a regular basis with people among educators or among employers? Is there any kind of active attempt to help people rethink the employment process, for example?
Absolutely. So I was invited to give a speech at the United Nations in New York on Autism Awareness Day. And I made the focus of my speech all about autism and human rights, you know, the right to work, the right to education, you know, because a lot of autistic people are falling outside of these basic human rights. So we do need to sort of make sure this message gets heard, not simply by putting it into a book like this one, but talking to policymakers, talking to those who design schools, who design colleges, talking to employers, just to get them to rethink how can we make sure that both education and the workplace is inclusive. And you've probably heard of this new word, neurodiversity. You know, the idea that people have different types of brains. One is not better or worse than another, they're simply different. But at the moment, you know, workplaces may be kind of biased towards people who love to socialize, love to communicate, and that can inadvertently exclude people who struggle with those things.
You know, what really speaks to me in this is the manner in which you are making the argument. You are not arguing that we make a concession. You're not arguing for remedial efforts. You're talking about actually valuing a skill set and an aptitude that we just have overlooked altogether. And this is an entirely positive approach to selling the reform we need.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can see it in different ways. You know, one way that I sometimes speak to employers is to say that by hiring autistic people, they may be increasing the likelihood of innovation and therefore profit or productivity in whatever sector they're working in. But the other way that we should all be thinking about this is, what kind of a world do we want? What kind of society do we want? Do we want a world where 2% of the population is left out, which is really what we're talking about with autistic people, left unemployed? And we know that unemployment leads to poor mental health. And we know that there are very high rates of suicide amongst autistic adults because we've left them out. You know, or do we want a world where everybody is included, or at least given a fair opportunity for education and for work, and not be discriminated on the grounds of disability.
Simon Baron Cohen, a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you. Thank you so much for being with us today on Constant Wonder.
Thank you, Marcus.
Simon Baron Cohen, a very well-known clinical psychologist and professor of psychology and psychiatry at Cambridge. He's director of the Autism Research Center there and author of The Pattern Seekers, How Autism Drives Human Invention. On the whole, I'd have to say we're getting a bit better these days about embracing people who don't think exactly the way we happen to think. Autism is generating more empathy, improved understanding these days. We're probably even doing much better. Oh, I think we're certainly doing much better than previous generations when it comes to common mental health situations, conditions such as depression or bipolar disorder. But really understanding someone who suffers from, let's say, psychosis or schizophrenia, those can be a bit intimidating, especially when so many of us haven't had any great depth of experience in these realms. We're going to speak with an advocate who lives with such a condition when Constant Wonder returns in just a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We've heard the term neurodiversity earlier this hour. We've been talking about the pattern-seeking capability that often characterizes persons with autism. And we're going to turn now to a different condition, a different pathology that's very frustrating to us, debilitating to individuals living with it, the condition known as schizophrenia. What's it like to live with this kind of psychosis? Well, to find out, I took the opportunity a while back to speak with Cecilia McGow, who is a New York City-based mental health activist. McGow is founder and director of Students with Psychosis, an organization that previously was known as Students with Schizophrenia. I spoke with her when she was still a college student at Penn State and just getting going with her advocacy work. McGow's college career and the rigor of her studies at Penn State, as it turned out, were an important part of coming to a better understanding for her, and now vicariously a better understanding for me, of the complete person behind this kind of diagnosis.
Yes, I am currently at a Penn State, at Penn State University.
And I understand that you have quite the scientific background too. You are studying something that has to do with stuff I would never understand. Tell us about that.
For quite a while, I was studying astronomy and astrophysics at Penn State. So I got really interested in astronomy back in high school. Quite a space nerd, actually. I was collaborated with the Pulsar Search Collaboratory, and in high school, I was lucky enough to have actually co-discovered a pulsar. A pulsar is a super dense neutron star that emits dipole electromagnetic radiation. And it really opened some doors for me, such as I was a Virginia Aerospace Science and Technology Scholar through NASA and also helped represent the United States in the International Space Olympics in Russia.
So everything you have just said goes against a stereotype. Because we, in American society, for many years, we don't think, I don't know why, I mean, we don't think of science and scholarship and intellectual prowess coming together with schizophrenia. Am I wrong about that stereotype? It seems to me that that's kind of where we've been.
True, there is that sort of stereotype that that someone with schizophrenia can't accomplish their dreams or can't pursue a science, technology, engineering, or mathematics career. So there is that stereotype. There's quite a few different stereotypes associated with schizophrenia. So that's one of them. But also on the flip side, sometimes people think of schizophrenia as because they think of the different media representations also of schizophrenia. So there's that movie, A Beautiful Mind, for example. I don't know if you've watched that. It's reaccounting John Nash's life, who got a Nobel Prize. And so sometimes people sort of have the stereotype of like, oh, you must be really smart. You have schizophrenia, or, oh, you can't accomplish your dreams. But sort of both stereotypes aren't that good, because say, for example, when I was studying astronomy and astrophysics, I was studying astronomy and astrophysics because I was interested and I loved it, and it wasn't because I had schizophrenia. So we just need to try to stay away from both type of stereotypes.
Yeah, it's almost as though we jump into the cause and effect scenarios and we think we know all of the effects of all the causes, or we want to see like a one-to-one correspondence that, well, this person did this because of fill in the blank. And in your case, somebody would say, well, that's what we should expect from somebody suffering from schizophrenia, right?
Right, right. And someone who has schizophrenia, that's just a small facet of them. It's not their whole identity. That's why I'm very much a person first terminology. Like when we were founding students with schizophrenia, we called it students with schizophrenia, not like something like schizophrenic students or something like that, because it's not our whole identity. It's not the reason for why we pursue certain career paths or something like that. So it is just a part of who, just a small part of who we are and not our full identity.
I really like that you pointed out the person first terminology. You probably heard it. I was going down that road in just the sentence before that. I almost used the word schizophrenic and backed off of it and then said the person suffering with schizophrenia. On a day-to-day basis, we're so accustomed to going down that road. Do you get opportunity to explain to your audiences this whole notion of why the person first terminology is so important?
Yeah. So again, I am a strong advocate for person first terminology, because I think it's important to make sure that we are talking about that person. But also I want to be on sort of the talk about the sort of the flip side of that as well, because there are advocates out there that mental health advocates out there that are proud of calling themselves a schizophrenic. Mm. And I don't want to in any way offend them, because my stance, to be honest, is if that person is empowered by reclaiming that word, then I all power to them. But when talking about people in general who have schizophrenia, or someone who doesn't have schizophrenia, referring to a person who has schizophrenia, then yeah, using that person-first terminology is appropriate.
Well, Cecilia, I want to get into your own story, your personal story of the discovery, of the diagnosis. But before we do that, just to set this up, it would be really helpful if you could give us, and you do this a lot for a lot of audiences, just a sense for the broad range of what falls under this diagnosis, because there's so many different things that could be present, and the symptoms aren't all the same, and the experiences are varying.
Yeah, yeah. Schizophrenia is definitely very much an umbrella-like diagnosis. Some of the hallmark characteristics can be hallucinations, delusions, or scattered thoughts. But it's very important to know that someone who has schizophrenia might not hallucinate or might not have delusions. So everyone's story with schizophrenia is very unique to their own. And when I'm talking today, I'm going to be just talking more on my personal experience.
Yeah. And you just said two words that I want to kind of compare with each other. One is hallucinations. The other is delusions. It would be pretty easy to lump those together, but we have different words for them. Do you sort those out in any particular way?
Yes. How to really define the difference between a delusion and a hallucination is, when you think of a hallucination, think of it more of like more sensory when it comes to like a visual hallucination, seeing something that's not there, or an auditory hallucination, hearing something that's not there. But a delusion is more of believing in a false belief. So believing in something that's not real, say thinking, the cliche is thinking the FBI is after you or something like that. But sometimes they do get kind of meshed together. So it's easy to maybe get them confused, because, for example, a person might hallucinate something and then have sort of the delusion that it's real. So sometimes they could kind of go together. So it is something to easily get confused.
And as you tell your story, I'm going to be very interested in hearing what your own experience has been. I do understand that it involved hallucination, and it'd be interesting also to see if you believe those hallucinations, if you had to figure out what is true, what is false, what to trust of your sensory experience. So what happened to you? Where were you? What age? How did this all, the diagnosis come about?
Yes. So I am someone who struggles with hallucinations. I'm lucky that I don't struggle with delusions. So only hallucinations. But so I've had what's called a childhood schizophrenia, but it became much, much more prevalent, though, in more of my end of my high school, beginning of college career. So when I was younger, it was more of shadowy figures. I remember my dad would call Mr. Blob Man, and they would think it was just like, they would joke around thinking it was a ghost or something. And then when I started to grow up, started to get older, it became more, I started getting auditory hallucinations, where it became sort of that, sort of like the staticky whispers in my ears, sort of like if you're on a radio, going between the different radio stations and you're like picking up two different radio stations. So nothing like very clear, but then it ended up more audio hallucinations. And then in my junior year, more of my junior year of high school, I started getting the more full-blown out visual hallucinations along with tactile hallucinations, which are feeling things that aren't there.
Is it awkward or uncomfortable to talk about any of this?
It's gotten easier to talk about the more outreach that I've done. So again, like going back to what we talked about, how I believe that opening up about my schizophrenia has actually helped empower me, because it used to be very uncomfortable talking about my hallucinations, to the point that if I started talking about them, it would be very triggering and very, very difficult for me. But because I've done this outreach and I've been able to have these conversations in a very safe and accepting atmosphere, it's gotten easier for me to talk about this. But thank you for asking.
Well, the reason I ask is because I know that when you present in public, I've seen the TEDx talk, you actually get very descriptive of the, and you're specific about what the hallucinations have consisted of. And I don't want to go down that road if that's a problem, but the curiosity is clearly here for anybody hearing. You know, people want to know, for example, do you like talking about the clown? Because you did in that talk, and yet I would imagine it's you don't want to do that on a daily basis.
True. I do always have to kind of make sure that I'm checking in on myself, making sure that I'm setting sometimes those healthy boundaries. I am comfortable about talking about that hallucination. That is one of the more common hallucinations that I have. I do hallucinate the clown that sort of resembles sort of the older adaptation of Stephen King's It. So not the newer movie that came out recently, but more of the older one that was played by Tim Curry. So I do hallucinate that clown. And then I also hallucinate a girl that looks very similar to the girl from The Ring. I've never watched that movie, but that's sort of like what I've been told it's sort of similar to. And also I hallucinate giant spiders and also small spiders. Actually, with the small spiders, that's the only time I really have difficulty on discerning whether or not my hallucination is real or not. Because we see, we see little spiders in everyday life.
Yeah, they exist. Small spiders actually exist. Yeah.
So, so, I mean, I try to look at my life in a sort of a positive lens. I even though I don't like my hallucinations, obviously, they're very negative. They are something that would probably belong more in a nightmare than real life, but sort of the positive lens that I try to look at this through is, at least since it's such negative things that I know doesn't belong in the real world, then it's easier for me to know it's not real, if that makes sense.
Well, from what I know about you, when you first started coming to terms with this and started seeking help, professional help, at some point you had to tell somebody, you had to say, I'm seeing things. I am hallucinating things. That must have been just even the very first time you articulated it to somebody. That must have been difficult.
Yeah, it was, it's not something you want to tell someone because we live in, a society where, if you tell someone you see something or hear something that's not real, that's sort of almost the definition of quote unquote crazy. Like people think of you as that when you say that. And so it's very, very difficult to open up about hallucinations. I remember I didn't open up to really anyone in high school. I opened up to my family and I opened up to my boyfriend at the time. And actually my high school boyfriend, I don't blame him. I didn't know what schizophrenia was and he didn't know what schizophrenia was. I told him about the clown and he actually laughed about it, because he had never watched the movie It. And so he like watched some YouTube clips and he actually thought it was more funny than scary. So that initial reaction actually made it more difficult for me to open up. And I didn't even open up until I was at college to someone else, because, if you open up to your boyfriend and they don't understand, then, thinking of opening up to, just a friend just seems sort of impossible because you don't want to be laughed at or even worse, the thought of being as crazy.
Yeah. So you got treatment at some point. How did you succeed in getting treatment?
So I finally got treatment while I'm here at Penn State. It was my sophomore year at Penn State when I finally got the treatment. Unfortunately, it was 8 months after a suicide attempt. And the reason why it took so long was because I was getting a very, very negative feedback from my parents and my family in general, was because pretty much they did not want me to talk to anyone about what was going on. They didn't want me to open up about my hallucinations to even a professor or anyone, because they were afraid that it would go on to our medical history and that people would think that I was crazy, people would think that I was dangerous, or I wouldn't be able to get a job, and that it might affect my future or my family's future in a way.
And that's all right back to the traditional stigmatization that we're so very good at as a society. At some point, though, for you, in order to get treatment, you had to, in your own mind, discount whatever people were saying to you about this stigma.
Yes, yeah. I ended up, going to the counseling services here at Penn State because it had gotten to a point with my schooling where I realized that I needed help. I needed that help because, again, it was 8 months after a suicide attempt. I had a suicide attempt in that February of that year, and then later in the fall, I thought that maybe things would get better in the summer when I had taken some time off of school, but it didn't. I needed to get that professional medical help, and that was crucial because I honestly do not think that I would be here today if I didn't get that proper medical treatment.
And the statistics are very clear about what happens among people suffering from schizophrenia, just very high numbers of suicide attempts, and of course, many do succeed in killing themselves. You are one of the lucky ones, and so now you're on the road, as it were, and you're talking about this every chance you get. You even are very, very active online in a social media presence. Has there been some... Do you get feedback from people enough that it kind of picks you up and makes you feel like you're doing some good. I'm just wondering what kind of feedback you're getting.
I absolutely love the community of people who have schizophrenia. It was very scary for me to open up that I had schizophrenia, because even I talked about that I got treatment. It still was quite a while before I chose to open up. And finding fellow people who have schizophrenia was also a part of finding a good support network. And through my outreach, I have found so many amazing individuals. Sometimes people think that I'm an anomaly about my schizophrenia and that I'm able to function. I'm not an anomaly. There are so many amazing people out there with schizophrenia. The thing is, there's just not enough people out there that are open about it. That's what's more of the anomaly about it. It's because what I found is sometimes when people are able to hide their schizophrenia, then they kind of choose to do that. So there's sort of this misrepresentation of what people who have schizophrenia are like. Because if someone can pretty much kind of hide their schizophrenia, I've seen happening. And so I really hope that more people open up about their schizophrenia, because we do need to change that face of schizophrenia.
So you're a person with schizophrenia. You are an advocate in a way that is meant to give support and solidarity to the community of people and their families and friends. Have you gotten to the point yet where you consider yourself anything like an expert on the topic?
Expert is a very...
It's a broad term.
A very broad term. I wouldn't quite say that. That's why I try to very much clarify that when I talk about schizophrenia, I talk about it from a personal experience.
Sure.
Because again, everyone's experience is unique. I do feel like I'm lucky enough to be very immersed in the community of people who have schizophrenia, and I in some ways I can speak on sort of their behalf in ways, but I don't want to speak for everyone's experience, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, what are the very best ways, and we've got a couple minutes, not much more than that, but the very best ways to address this for the general public? It's one thing to offer support to the community. Here we are on a radio program. We're getting some word out. What are you doing to reach the general public?
Well, making sure that we talk about schizophrenia more and make sure that we are having better representation of schizophrenia in the media, both on TV, in movies, and also especially in the news. Sometimes schizophrenia and mental health is only brought up, unfortunately, when, say, a violent crime happens or something like that. And the thing is, that's when people hear about schizophrenia. But the true thing is, someone with schizophrenia is actually more likely to be an abuse victim rather than an abuser. So there's this huge misconception that someone with schizophrenia is violent, and that's a terrible misconception. So that's a strong message we need to be getting out to the general public, because we need to break down this fear and the stigma that's associated with schizophrenia, because it's getting in the way of people getting the treatment that they need, and people are taking their lives. 1 out of 10 people who have schizophrenia take their lives through suicide, and 4 out of 10 attempt suicide at least once, myself included, and it's because of these stereotypes and this fear.
Cecilia McGow is the founder and director of Students with Psychosis. You're listening to Constant Wonder. Let's round things off for this hour on this topic with a few words now from the author of a prominent book about schizophrenia. Here are a few insights from Robert Kolker. He's author of Hidden Valley Road, Inside the Mind of an American Family. Nature versus nurture, predisposition versus environmental triggers. How much do we really know about schizophrenia's causes?
We have a little bit more solid ground than we used to now that the human genome has been sequenced. We can tell that there are definite genetic mutations that are correlated with schizophrenia. So even if those mutations aren't the big smoking gun that we can attack to cure the disease, and they certainly aren't. They only affect it a little bit. It's proof that this is a biological condition, and as if we needed any more proof, because years of MRIs and PET scans of brains of people with schizophrenia have shown biological differences as well. So that's the beginning. We're really at the beginning of the next chapter. But for the last 100 years, we've been in this very nebulous, murky, frustrating first chapter where we're just struggling to classify the symptoms into an illness. This would be the right time to point out that schizophrenia is not a disease the way that COVID-19 is a disease. We know molecularly what COVID-19 is. Schizophrenia is a syndrome. It's a word we've created to classify a lot of symptoms. And so it's possible that decades from now, we may look back and see that really it's really six different brain disorders that we had called schizophrenia. Or we might find that it simply is a generic term that we've used to discuss symptoms that have different origins. The best analogy I've heard is that centuries ago, when people had fevers, everybody thought that that fever was the disease. And so they would try to attack the fever any way they could. What we know now is that fever is a symptom, that sometimes it's caused by a virus, sometimes by an infection. And that may be the case with schizophrenia as well. So we're on, I guess the answer is twofold. We've been on, have not been on solid ground ever since we came up with the term, but we're starting to now. And so I try to trace that journey in Hidden Valley Road by talking about Freud and Jung and taking you through sort of some of the highlights of all of the struggles to try to figure out exactly what schizophrenia is. And then I also talk about the researchers who studied the Galvin family and how they became convinced that this family and others like them might actually be a better window into the illness than anything else out there. And hopefully on those two tracks, it kind of helps people understand why for so long we didn't understand the disease and why we are starting to now.
Robert Kolker is author of Hidden Valley Road, Inside the Mind of an American Family. On another topic, the New York Yankees pay their players a lot of money, and in exchange, all they have to do is win baseball games and keep their faces clean shaven. What they wear is a given. They've got to wear a uniform, right? And nobody balks about that. But what about all those other expectations of dress codes? We find them all over the planet. Do we really need them? We're going to survey the history of dress codes, and we're even going to wonder what you wear for a Zoom meeting. Coming up next on Constant Wonder.